people's sexuality. And unless you are going to completely eradicate sexuality, fantasy and desire on the one hand and poverty on the other, you won't ever get rid of it.
I agree with what Belinda said, and moreover, I will not forget that there are men and transsexual Absolutely. Persons in prostitution. in prostitution, so I would ameliorate the situation of the people who decide to sell sex, whether they are women, men, or transsexuals. Mm.
Do you believe that people do make a conscious decision to sell sex without being exploited or having something psychologically wrong with them?
I not only believe it, but that's a huge number of people I talk with who tell me that, and I see no reason to not believe them. No, of course, everybody makes decisions within the options that are available for him or her, and among those options, doing sex work can be a completely rational and useful choice to make.
Thank you very much indeed for talking to Women's Parliamentary Radio from Birkbeck College here in London. I've enjoyed it very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Wings thanks Bonnie Soans for sharing Women's Parliamentary Radio audio. Thanks also to your local radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughan, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Hey, everybody. I'm Kelly Jones, and you're listening to Pioneer Radio.
Let's talk about radio, because radio is so good.
I'm going to tell you something, Flacca, and I want you to listen tight.
Telling stories to regular folks is not a trivial thing.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
Even if it's hard to explain, even if you know they don't really want to hear it, not really, I urge you to give it a try.
You have my undivided attention.
Take a chance, find the words, find the metaphor, share the beauty, tell them a story.
Each week on Pioneer Radio, we choose a topic. We talk about it, we ask you to talk about it, and we ask some experts to weigh in. This week's topic is social networking. David Fincher's movie The Social Network came out last weekend and was expected to take home anywhere from $21 million to $27 million in its first three nights. The Social Network dramatically depicts Facebook creator Mark Zuckerberg's rise to fame and glory despite personal and legal obstacles. Being unable to afford to go to the movies these days, I haven't actually seen it. But here's how Columbia Pictures describes their movie. Quote, "As a battle over exactly what happened and who was there at the moment of creation, each of the super smart young men who claimed to be there at Facebook's inception has his own narrative, his own version of the Facebook story, but they add up to more than the sum of their parts in what becomes a multi-level portrait of 21st century success." Unquote. What I want to know is, what has this 21st century success got us? Why is Mark Zuckerberg's success so timely, so pivotal, and so easily made into an instant blockbuster? I'll argue that it is not, in fact, simply because North Americans continue to love stories of entrepreneurial victory. Rather, it's because we want the origin story not of Zuckerberg himself, but of his creation. Because Facebook was indeed revolutionary and continues to define many of our day-to-day lives, sometimes even hour by hour. No, really. Even if you're one of the few left in North America who has not created a profile, established a wall, and discovered the virtual soapbox of your status update, don't touch that dial. Facebook might not be your bag, but it's all around you, and, I'm going out on a limb here, but with reason to think that I should, Facebook determines the course of your contemporary life, both on the internet and off it, regardless of whether or not you've signed up. In the next half an hour, I'll talk to three people who are still not on Facebook. I'll compare and contrast their reasons for abstaining in order to ask, why do we sign up? Why do we share, post, like, tag, and creep? What has Mark Zuckerberg's 21st century success got us, and can we imagine a world without it? Well, for a week in September, Harrisburg University of Science and Technology in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, tried to do just that. In an experiment that was reported to be more annoying for its subjects than illuminating of some deep social trouble, the university blocked the use of Facebook, MySpace, Twitter, and instant messaging. Current Guelph resident and new media expert Ian Riley told us that universities struggling with their control over what students are and aren't allowed to do online is a struggle as old as the internet itself.
So back when Mass University systems, email systems in particular, but internet systems across university campuses were flourishing, a couple of universities were debating what kinds of architecture they would develop. The University of Chicago and Harvard University had two different trajectories. One was to have an open model where open access and anonymity were basically the cornerstones of how they wanted to develop the system. And the other model was to have a closed system that basically meant that students had to register and they had to adopt their names, their full names, and that they would be accountable for just about everything that they did. To my mind, I'm not sure which is the better course of action, but it's up for debate and definitely interesting. So this kind of feeds your, the topic for this particular program, where you're, trying to map and understand and make sense of, new technology and new media. And, Facebook and Twitter are at the forefront. At the current moment, you have over 500 million people on Facebook. I don't know what the numbers are for Twitter, but I imagine they're steadily growing. And people are using these media and these technologies for various purposes. And it's important to just map how they're being used and to what effect.
So what is this map telling us? If Ian is so interested in this debate, why isn't he on Facebook?
Well, Facebook is a really interesting case study, and most people like to talk about Facebook because it has a kind of universal cachet at the moment. So Facebook's interesting for a couple of reasons. I used to be a Facebook user. I was a Facebook user in 2006, roughly, for about 2 months. And I got off it almost immediately because it was a vacuum that I couldn't easily get out of. And it was also chewing up a lot of my time because its interface is so wonderful and the applications are brilliant. And it's easy to use, and you can stay in touch with people. You can unlock parts of your creativity and originality that are dormant. And you can basically create an alter ego, a personality that is far better than the one that you actually embody on a day-to-day basis. But our concept of time changes, and our concept of labor changes, because I think that a lot of people aren't really appreciative of the fact that all the time that they spend on Facebook is labor.
I asked Ian why he used the word labor to refer to the kinds of things we do on Facebook. Labor is sort of a complicated word, after all. Does updating one's status every hour really fit this description of labor?
I think it is in part labor. I think it's part leisure. I also think it's part community building, because there are a lot of really interesting projects that take place on Facebook. Petitions for causes, some that revolve around the internet, like copyright law, changes to copyright law, to network neutrality, gay and lesbian activism, anything about the public sphere, postering, etc. There are a lot of really interesting initiatives, so I see it as a kind of hybrid form.
So it sounds like we can use Facebook to play, to work, to rally together. None of these seem like necessarily bad uses of our time. But Ian says there's a level of weird surveillance that accompanies Facebook use that doesn't really show up in other mediums of communication.
The thing that I think is probably most problematic about Facebook is that it encourages a society of surveillance that we willingly buy into, without ever really considering the consequences of what this will mean in the future. So there's that great example of you know, Alfred Hitchcock's Rear Window.
That's a secret private world you're looking into out there.
Stewart's character has a broken leg, and he's stuck in his apartment for 2 weeks. And all he has is a technological tool to assist him in getting through this really banal period of his life.
Sitting around looking out of the window to kill time is one thing, but doing it the way you are with binoculars and wild opinions about every little thing you see.
And soon enough, he becomes wrapped up in the lives of all of these boring and banal people that he's constantly making fun of, until one moment he believes that he may or may not have been the witness of, or has witnessed a crime of some sort, and then they eventually have to piece it together.
Let's start from the beginning again, Jeff. Tell me everything you saw.
Rear Window is a really interesting case study. Again, this film comes out in the 1950s, and it's interesting because this voyeurism and this kind of panoptic view of culture where we're allowed to be voyeurs and to enjoy it. I mean, there's a lot of pleasure in watching Rear Window, and there's a lot of pleasure in what they call, what, face creeping or Facebook creeping people. So you can basically surveil what all of your friends are doing, but also if you don't have the right locks on your account settings, you can see just about anyone's photo albums and see them well before you've met them in person. So a very common phenomenon now is for people to walk around and see people and know them quite intimately without having ever seen them in person. And that's precisely because we have this society of surveillance that is flourishing under something like Facebook.
In fact, Facebook seems not only to encourage surveillance, but to demand it, and not just from those doing the surveilling. In order to be a good citizen, a good member of the Facebook community, you're obligated to make yourself susceptible to surveillance. In light of this reciprocal surveillance, I asked another friend of mine who cares deeply about privacy to tell me why he refuses to join Facebook. This friend has other friends from all over the world, but values his low online profile so highly that he doesn't think Facebook use is worth the risk. He asked to remain anonymous for this interview.
Yeah, I don't know where this comes from. It's actually, it might have to do with the fact that I grew up in a country where privacy is valued very highly, because right now we're having this big public debate, and there was a lot of outcry about Google Street View, and people were up in arms against the idea that Google would just drive around and film your house and make it available to everyone online. So maybe my sense of privacy is in a way shaped by my background and my upbringing. But I don't really, first off, I don't have this exhibitionist urge to lay out my life to everyone who cares enough to look at it. So if I were to put stuff on Facebook, if it were really trivial, I would think that, you know, I might as well not waste my time. If it were really meaningful, then I would feel like I'm actually, you know, exhibiting something that I, you know, that I don't want to be stored on some, you know, server. I mean, I have no idea what people do with the data. And I think my big concern is that I'm very conscious of the kind of publicly available information about me. I just don't really feel comfortable that anyone, you know, knows all these things about me, whether they have good intentions or not. So in a way, I think Facebook almost coerces you into revealing much more than I would ever be willing to reveal.
If you think that sounds a bit paranoid, think again. Here's Ian.
Well, one of the reasons that I think that this kind of cultural practice is dangerous is because if we're encouraging surveillance in an everyday context like Facebook, where we can easily go and see what other people are doing, in many respects quite intimate things, it's not unheard of to think of what the future might hold when, you know, the state and any kind of corporate apparatus that wields any kind of power is using these technologies. So in the last decade, we've seen the rise of CCTV cameras, particularly in the UK and Australia. And these cameras are everywhere surveilling citizens. We don't quite know why they're flourishing. And my hunch is that if we allow for Facebook and other kinds of surveillance technology to flourish in the way that it does, then when there are severe breaches against our civil liberties, governments and corporations or corporate actors will only need to say, it's fine, what we're doing is not actually surveilling against you or creeping you or I don't know what the language is or working against your civil liberties. We're doing precisely what you're doing on Facebook. And then my worry is that people will simply see that and say, well, if it's just like Facebook, then what harm can it cause?
If Facebook, and internet use in general, for that matter, poses such a risk to our coveted privacy, what is it that people think they stand to gain from its use?
I can see the narcissistic appeal of it. I mean, I've done this myself where I filled out, you know, profiles and listed all my favorite things. And sometimes it's just nice to see all, you know, the things that you never really articulate for yourself in front of you. Mm-hmm. But I'm not really sure how that is empowering. If anything, I would say, you know, being a bit more secretive about yourself, not allowing for anyone to, you know, be able to categorize you, whether it's, you know, according to your favorite music or your political views or the people who you call your friends and those things. I think that can also be, you know, it's like the power to withhold something and to withdraw yourself from this greed for, I don't know, even the most intimate information about yourself. I actually find that perhaps more empowering.
Again, my friend has friends from all over the world. I asked him whether his friends found it annoying to have to keep in touch with him through means other than Facebook. Here's what he said.
I mean, people find it really inconvenient that they have to go out of their way and send me individual invitations to things. And I don't mind that. I don't mind causing them that inconvenience. You know, if they care enough about me to have me, you know, if they care enough about my presence at a certain party, then, you know, I'd like to see that materialize in the form of an individual invitation. So I don't think I'm, you know, trying to make myself more important than I am, but maybe I think you just become you become kind of faceless. Yeah, in a way it does take away from your individuality. You become, you know, just one other person on Facebook.
Like my other friend, Dan Evans from The Bookshelf has many friends who live far from Guelph. We asked him about why he doesn't use Facebook to keep in touch with his friends, and we found that Dan is sort of an odd correspondent. Not only does he not use Facebook, but he confesses to be pretty bad at keeping in touch in general. And the strange thing is, it doesn't seem like that's really a bad thing.
I have this friendship diaspora, you know, just to rudely co-opt the term there, but I have all these friends who were my friends in town or in Toronto or something, and then they've gone on to do work elsewhere, graduate work or buy a home or something. So I have all these best friends, quote unquote, who I never see. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I faced this reality of having the closest people who have affected me the most in the best ways, not actually in my life, in my daily life. And I thought that was a definition for bad friendship, for poor friends, and that I was a poor friend because I let it happen, you know? Mm. And then another topic that came up was, you know, how come you don't keep in touch with these people then if there's technology that makes it so easy to do so? Say, mm-hmm. signing up to Facebook with all my 20 best friends who live across the planet. And I think that a simplified answer for me, you can probe me about this if you want, but is that I don't know if it makes it any better to be moderated by a technological device. And so what I had with these people when it was active was a face-to-face, maybe not daily, but sort of, you know, somewhat regular, actual interaction. And that's what made our friendship so strong. We built experiences together. Not that you can't build experiences over the phone or through the computer, but I just personally don't find them as rich. Mm-hmm. So I'm faced with this, you know, I was going to say midlife. I don't want to say midlife. I'm faced with this reality a few years later of having great friends in my life who I never see.
Do you write letters?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the first phase of this diaspora was to invent a game. We were all over the place, and we invented a letter-writing game that came with cards, kind of playing cards. There's sort of a comic book kind of, independent movie snobbery or geekery in common between us, and so it led itself naturally to things like card collecting, you know? So we made this game where we set up dimensions for the card and dimensions for the box and a few loose rules, like if you received a letter, it had to come accompanied by a card. And if you received one, you had to give one. It had to be someone else in the group. It didn't have to be the person you got it from. So this flow of letters and cards, and it was working really well. Of course, it became more of an art project than actual correspondence, and so we were more of like a loose collective of bad artists, of collage artists, than friends. But it was, I mean, that's a great question because it gave us a common experience. So yeah, there's some letter writing going on. When you summarize your experience for your friends in a letter, you know, when you tell them what has been happening to you, there's like, you know, a tendency to brag a little bit or just to get lost in sort of self-assessment. And I think what's missing is huddling around a beer and dreaming abstractly about possible futures.
For Dan, the thing that's missing from Facebook or MySpace or Twitter or instant messaging is a common experience that can't help but give birth to creative projects. He feels that the publicity of those social mediums take away from the authenticity of a common creative experience, and that technologically mediated experiences tend to warp our styles of expression.
Why does your connection with somebody either dim or amplify if it's made public? What sort of sinister mechanism of celebrity is at work when you feel great about leaving a good three sentences and, you know, on somebody else's viewable public wall, something like that? What makes you feel good about yourself because you wrote a really snappy paragraph? I once was asked to speak at a funeral of a friend of mine who died in high school. Pretty serious, lofty stuff. Thought way too long about it, of course. Was frightened by it and then honored by the suggestion, and then in the end I abused it because I wrote a poem, I think. It was a poem, or, you know, it was a something. I wrote something, and I invested in the writing. Mm. And so, therefore, I invested differently in the delivery of it. And I remember twin feelings afterwards of, I hope people liked my writing, you know? I hope what I said was meaningful, but not in the good way. Like, I hope it was artistic. I hope it sounded good. And then the other voice, or one of the many other voices in my head saying, how could you use this opportunity to pay tribute to your friend to sort of elevate your own artistic celebrity, even however minor it may be? You know, and I felt echoes of that kind of ego war throughout my life, and I suspect most of us do. It's not terrible because it fuels you, right? It's a good way to be artful. But I would hate to get caught up in having all of my friendships as organs for that force, you know? Constantly being worried about what people think of my writing or my spelling mistakes or how eloquent I am digitally because everything I say is being mapped. So that sounds like a paranoid. That sounds way more paranoid than I actually feel. But it changes the style of expression, I think. The medium, of course it does.
It's pretty easy to see how a medium like Facebook or Twitter can alter one's means of expression. After all, our creativity is limited to wall posts or 140 characters at a time. But all innovative hope is not lost. It just so happens that Ian Reilly wants to push the kind of creative projects generated by social media as far as he can.
You know, this proliferation of user-generated content in some ways creates innovation or forces innovation's hand. So I'm not sure if the internet is peaking at the moment. There's a real possibility that it is. Has it hit its plateau yet? I hope not, because it really is a wonderful tool. And I'd like to see it continue to flourish, and I'd like to continue to see user-generated content. I think that that's probably one of the greatest facets of the internet. You know, the fact that all of a sudden, the one thing that really changes with the internet is people now have the means of production and the means of distribution, which changes the game completely. We're no longer relying on major media corporations to give us content. We don't have to wait for Sunday night in order to watch a program. We can create the program and simultaneously or instantaneously broadcast it to all of our friends. We can create updates on our Facebook so that people know that it is going to be broadcast at this very moment in time. And we can ensure that we'll have a following and that people will respond to whatever it is that we're doing, which is, I think, a really empowering thing for a lot of people.
Can we really be that optimistic about user-generated photos of kitties that want cheeseburgers, for example? What is the value of user-generated content if it's always at the risk of being trivial and, frankly, stupid?
I don't necessarily create media for the internet, but a lot of my students do, and I actually make them do that because I want them to understand what it means to be part of this broader culture, where they not only have access to the means of production, but they can actually disseminate, you know, cultural texts that are really, really important. And if anything, it will allow them to associate differently with people, people that they've yet to meet, people that they will possibly never know.
What Ian is trying to teach is media literacy. We can avoid an influx of cheeseburger cats and temper the Facebook-induced ADD during class if we can teach people to be just as critical of social media as they are proponents of it, and to be responsible about the content that they generate. Hopefully, this will push the public nature of the internet in a more democratic and creative direction. So, since Ian's a teacher, I asked him about the banning of Facebook at Harrisburg.
I'm tempted to say that all of the students in my class would be incredibly bored. And they would have to spend more time focusing on some of the material, the concepts, the theories, the debates that we're talking about, and that would be incredibly tedious for them. My friends, my very close friends, believe that students of this incoming generation have attention deficit disorder, so it would be virtually impossible for them to follow even three sentences. And I guess it begs the question, if you take out Twitter or Facebook, then students will just move to a new technological or media platform. They will move to MSN. They will move to email. They will take out their phones and start texting. They will put in their earphones discreetly under their hair and listen to music. They will find a way to not listen to you. That is the pessimistic view. If we treat Facebook and Twitter as technological tools that can enhance learning, then maybe that is a better approach. Some professors have adopted the technology with varying degrees of success. But again, the thing that's great about media, and technology in particular, is that it's all part of an ongoing experiment. You know, I use these things in the class because it is an experiment. Some things will work better than others. Are we bastardizing, you know, public discourse? I don't know, maybe. But there's a chance that we might actually be allowing people to understand dense ideas. We might actually be able to tap into people's desires about learning, desires to participate in a broader community. Say we do an activist project in my classroom, they can use Twitter as a platform to, invite people in on this broader project. You know, that's just it's a communication medium that simply allows for the exchange of ideas, and it's how you use it that is most important.